Good evening, and welcome to our teleconference session, How to Reduce Conflict and Create Harmony in Your Marriage. Hopefully you have the outline in front of you that was sent to you. And so I want to spend the next 45 to 50 minutes discussing a topic that I believe is crucial, absolutely crucial to the success of any marriage. In fact, marriage experts have said that it's probably the number one most important skill that couples can have in creating a strong, lasting marriage. We said how to reduce conflict. We certainly don't want to eliminate it, although it would seem that would be a good thing on the surface. But our goal is not to eliminate conflict. We're going to see that conflict can be something that can be an asset to a relationship. But we do want to reduce it. We do want to reduce it and in the process leverage it to create harmony in our marriage. And so that's what we're going to spend some time together working on this evening. First of all, I just want to say this important assumption. I think it's inevitable that when you put two fallen people together, that there will be tension and friction. That is certainly to be expected in a relationship, because conflict is inevitable in every marriage, and because it has such potential to make or break your relationship, one of the most powerful things that you can do to protect your marriage is, as you see there on your outline in item A, is to learn constructive ways to handle it. And so we're going to give you some very practical tools that will help you to handle conflict in constructive ways that can push you closer together rather than pulling you apart. Item B, conflict can either push us closer together or it can pull us apart, depending on how we handle it. Well, first of all, we need to understand that when we're dealing with conflict, we're dealing with anger, and so what becomes very important is that we deal with anger, that we become aware of its influence in our interactions, and that we practice. And when I say practice, it takes lots of practice to achieve self-control. Item A on your outline, God gave us the emotion of anger. He gave it to us. It's God-given, and He gives us permission to be angry. But He just wants us to distinguish between two types of anger, that is righteous anger and what I would call unrighteous anger or sinful anger. The Scripture says in Ephesians 4:26, be angry and yet do not sin. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. In other words, what the Scripture is saying there is that God gives us permission to be angry. He's telling us that is a human emotion. It's the way He created us. It has a purpose and a positive function in our lives. And yet, because of the nature of anger, He says we've got to be very careful not to sin and not to let the sun go down on our anger. So, obviously, anger can be good and anger can be harmful. Item B, righteous anger is unselfish. It's expressed and resolved in appropriate ways that honors your mate's right to dignity and to safety and to security. Righteous anger is an unselfish type of anger that requires a choice and a commitment to express oneself in a commitment, a dedication to that end, to express oneself in appropriate ways. Item C on your outline, sinful anger is anger that is selfishly expressed through inappropriate words and deeds that are meant to threaten, to punish, and or to hurt your mate. Conflict and strife is the result of sinful anger. James 4:1 says, "Do you know where your fights and arguments come from? They come from the selfish desires that war within you." Colossians 3:8 says, "But now you must rid yourself of all such things as these: anger, rage, slander, and filthy language from your lips." Notice he's talking about ridding ourselves, and he associates the kind of anger that he's talking about there is the unrighteous anger, the anger that is inappropriately expressed through rage or malice or inappropriate language. Sinful anger in marriage is often rooted, I believe, in a belief that my mate should never do anything to upset me. It's when I get to thinking that my mate should always act in ways that makes me feel comfortable and happy. And then when my mate does something that upsets me or causes me discomfort and unhappiness, what happens then is I react. And I do one or two things. One, I punish him or her for making me unhappy. Or two, I try to get him or her to change through demands and intimidation so that he or she will stop doing what is making me uncomfortable and unhappy and only do what makes me comfortable and happy. Do you see where we're coming from with that point D on your outline? It is about your belief, your idealistic belief that your mate should never, and that's the key word, never do anything to upset you, but should always, the key word always, act in ways that makes you comfortable and happy. Let's just come to the understanding now that in marriage, our mate is not going to live up to that unrealistic expectation. Our mate is going to do something to upset us. Our mate is not perfect. Neither are we. We are fallen individuals. We are different from each other, and we have different personalities and different perceptions, and we are going to say things and do things that are upsetting to each other. If we insist on interpreting those assets as direct hits against us, direct attempts to hurt us, if we're going to insist on believing that our mate should never do anything to upset us, then we are going to live in a continuous state of upset. Do you see how important that belief is? Believing that my mate should always act in ways that makes me comfortable and happy is a false expectation. Is it a desire? Yes. As husband and wife, we would like to think that one of our mate's deepest wishes and desires would be to make us happy. As husband and wife, yes, we would hope that would be the case. But Will they always be able to make us comfortable? No. And do I need to punish him or her as a result? No. So, sinful anger hurts so much because there is a vulnerability in marriage unlike any other relationship. And whether we admit it or not, we care deeply what our mate thinks about us. We desperately want to be loved, to be admired, to be cherished, respected, and valued. And we want them to not do things that upset us. We want them to make us comfortable and happy, just as that's what we desire to do for them. But when we experience conflicts and criticism, it strikes directly at this desire. We are forced to admit that we have failings and faults, and our mate has failings and faults. Not only this, but most of us are considerably more sensitive than we particularly might let on to be. When we get our feelings hurt at work or by a friend, we have to control ourselves so we don't let it show. We look like maybe at work or out in our public self, it might appear that we kind of have crocodile skin. But the reality is that in those kind of situations, we are utilizing, exerting self-control. Those things that people say to us really do matter. Rejection, slights, and rude comments really can hurt us, but they can be minimized through self-control and through realizing that occasionally, sometimes, our mate is going to do something that upsets us, and that many times there will be ways that our mate acts in ways that don't make us comfortable and happy. And learn that just because that happens does not mean they do not love us, or does not mean that we cannot accept and handle such incidents. The belief there is extremely crucial to how we respond. Item E on your outline, sinful anger creates fear, destroying trust and security in the relationship and making your marriage no longer safe. James 1:20 says, "For man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires." Sinful anger harms both parties. It destroys love. It puts the marriage relationship at risk. And it displeases God. We've seen several passages where God expresses his views on sinful anger. And anger, again, does not become sinful until it is expressed in inappropriate words or actions that can be harmful to a relationship or to another person. Sinful anger harms both parties. And if there's repeated outbursts of anger, they need to be dealt with seriously. And they may even indicate the need for help and godly counsel. Well, moving along, page 2, item 3 on your outline. In order to reduce conflict and to use self-control, we need to identify and to avoid four patterns that can harm a relationship. These patterns we're going to look at are accentuated by the arousal effects of anger. And so we're going to see that anger is working through these four patterns sometimes. And what we're going to do after we've looked at these four patterns and identified how those happen so that we can recognize those and avoid them in ourselves, I'm also going to give you a couple of excellent tools that will help you deal with all four of these patterns. But first of all, let me just talk briefly about the patterns. First of all, on your outline A, escalation occurs when spouses negatively respond back and forth to each other, continually upping the ante so that conditions get worse and worse. You know, anger escalates when couples engage in sequences of aversive behaviors that are designed to intimidate or to control the other person. Patterns of reactions and counter-reactions can play out with incredible speed. For instance, the sudden introduction of a sore or a controversial subject in a conversation or conflict can trigger a rapid escalation. You're, for instance, in the middle of a conversation about car repairs, and suddenly the discussion takes a sharp left turn into one partner's spending habits. 1 Peter 3:9 says, "Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult." This is exactly what happens with escalation. Each negative comment increases the level of anger and frustration, and soon a small disagreement is in the process of expanding, escalating, and blowing up before we know it into a major fight. But in those nanoseconds, from the moment the first few words were spoken to the moment there was an insult or a misunderstanding or a response, escalation begins to occur in those nanoseconds after that. In those seconds afterwards when couples begin to go back and forth. The way we communicate verbally and non-verbally plays a major role in this. Our tone of voice, our facial expressions, and our body language can exacerbate conflict, or it can reduce it. I think some of us fail to see how intimidating we can look and sound. Sometimes I think it would be helpful to go have an argument or a conflict with yourself in front of the mirror and just get a look at those facial expressions, the tone of voice. Those are extremely important ways of communicating, and when they're communicated in a negative way, those are things that can come to bear on causing an interaction to escalate. Be careful what your facial expressions are. Be careful what your tone of voice is. Avoid escalation. A second pattern that can harm a relationship is called invalidation. It's a pattern in which one spouse subtly or overtly puts down the thoughts, the feelings, or the character of another. Sometimes comments that are intentionally or unintentionally can lower the self-esteem of another person. Some comment like, "You're acting like a creep," or "You sure are upset about what your boss said. That wasn't all that bad." In invalidation, saying that someone's feelings of sadness or frustration are unfounded or inappropriate or unimportant or minimizing them or reducing them. Another form of invalidation occurs whenever you're expecting praise or appreciation for some positive action and your mate ignores it. Ignoring it can be a way of invalidating a person, while highlighting, on the other hand, some minor problem. In other words, instead of noticing the good that your mate did and affirming it, you decide to not only ignore it, but you also point out some other lack of action that they did something you didn't like. That can increase that invalidation. Like, suppose you worked hard all afternoon to clean up and to reorganize the game room, and your spouse came home and complained because you didn't stop by the store and pick up the things that he or she had asked for. You know, invalidation hurts. It leads to naturally covering up who you are and what you think. If somebody invalidates you and continues to either by not acknowledging you or by minimizing you, it becomes too risky to engage with that person. People naturally cover up their innermost feelings when they think they'll be put down. Research shows that invalidation is one of the main predictors of future problems and divorce. Invalidation is a highly toxic poison to the well-being of your relationship. I hope you get the picture. By validation, we mean that the one raising the concern is being respected and heard. That when a person is expressing their feelings, their opinions, their upsets, we don't minimize them, disregard them, refuse to respond to them. You don't have to agree with your partner to validate his or her feelings. Validation is a powerful tool that you can use to build intimacy and to reduce anger, frustration, and resentment. But invalidation works against you, and it works against the relationship. Invalidation is a pattern that can harm a relationship, and a pattern that we must identify in ourselves and avoid. Well, the third harmful pattern that I want to point out, item C on your outline, is withdrawal. Withdrawal and avoidance are different ways of expressing one's unwillingness to get into or to stay with sensitive discussions. You know, withdrawal can be manifested when one person just stands up and says, I don't want to talk about this, or leaves the room when an uncomfortable subject arises. It can be subtler when a person zones out or gets quiet in a conversation and just refuses to engage or to respond. Avoidance is when one does his best to, like, suppress a topic or make sure this topic never comes up and refuses to look at it. Both withdrawal and avoidance show an unwillingness to participate in important discussions. Escalation, invalidation, withdrawal. They're risk factors identified by researchers at the University of Denver. The last of these two descriptors, withdrawal and avoidance, these are two different manifestations of the problem where a partner is unwilling to get in or stay in discussion that's too threatening. The last one is negative interpretations. Negative interpretations occur when one partner believes that the motives of the other are more negative than is usually the case. Usually, again, here comes anger and resentment. It is why the Lord admonishes us to not let the sun go down on our anger, because if we do harbor anger that becomes resentment and eventually bitterness, then that will turn into negative thoughts and negative interpretations about that person. A wife may believe that her husband doesn't like her parents, and as a result, she may attack him anytime he's not overly enthusiastic about visiting them. He may be concerned maybe with the financial cost of going home for Christmas or about whether he has enough vacation time. But instead, she in turn considers his behavior as disliking her parents. She thinks he dislikes his parents because of something he said 2 years ago that he was upset about, and she has drawn this negative interpretation, when truthfully, his reluctance to go home at Christmas time may be more about his sincere concern about the financial costs or about his vacation time. Another kind of negative interpretation is mind reading. Mind reading occurs when you assume you know what your partner is thinking or why she did something, reading into a situation. It's very possible and very frequent that couples who are at odds with each other and who have unresolved conflicts will make negative interpretations and read into each other's actions and think negatively and judge their partner's negative motives as negatives when they were truly completely innocent. I'm not saying that every motive of our partner is innocent. I am only saying that there are some situations that occur when there are unresolved issues in a marriage relationship that will cause us to be, or can cause us to be, predisposed in our thinking to a negative way of mind reading and falsely accusing our mate of motives that are just not so. Research shows that in distressed marriages, there is a tendency for partners to discount the positive things they see. To discount those. To the very things that we once considered things where we liked, just because we're mad at this person, now those things that we used to like, we interpret them as things we don't like any longer. Anger. It is why anger, resentment, bitterness, unresolved conflict is so, so toxic to a relationship. Negative interpretations. And I think one of the keys to battling negative interpretations is to reconsider what you think about your partner's motives. What are you accusing your partner of? What are you assuming that your partner is guilty of? What automatic thoughts are you concluding about your mate? And are those thoughts that you have about that person's behavior, are those your emotional opinions, or are they fact? Perhaps your partner is more positive than you think. And I'm not this is not some unrealistic positive thinking program that I'm promoting, but I'm challenging you to have a realistic assessment of those negative assumptions that you may be bringing to your marriage. Did your spouse really forget, intentionally not do what you ask? Was it intentional, or could it have been purely accidental? Does he or she try to annoy you, or are you being more critical than is warranted? Most of the time, I found people think they're doing the best they can. And it hurts to be accused of something you never intended to do, to be hurtful. For couples to have a good marriage, this pattern of negative interpretation must be eliminated. What good is it doing in the relationship? It can be much like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you want your mate and your marriage to be diminished, then perhaps the thing to do would be to continue thinking negatively about everything about them and the marriage. On the other hand, if you'd like to break this cycle, then the way to do that is begin to challenge your own negative interpretations that you are making about your mate, and begin to engage yourself in healthier self-talk and conversation. I know often this is easier said than done, but I think first of all you have to ask yourself if your thinking might be overly negative. Might it be? Are you willing to humbly challenge yourself in this area? Do you give your spouse the benefit of the doubt? We're talking again about the concept of grace. Second, you have to push yourself to look for the evidence that is contrary to your negative interpretation. See, you may have held negative interpretations for so long, and you may have insisted that these certain behaviors were out of wrong motives for so long that it's often easier to see his or her speck than to see the plank that is in your own eyes. That's a reality. And so we need to look at negative interpretations and deal with them. Give your mate the benefit of the doubt, and don't let inaccurate interpretations sabotage your marriage. Well, I want to give you, as we come around the home stretch here to finish up, two valuable tools for helping you deal with anger and helping you deal with all four of these harmful patterns. These two items can help in both. First, item four on your outline, the first tool, is when anger escalates, call a timeout. Ephesians 4:29 suggests this, I think. It says, let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth, but only such a word as is good for edification according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear. Stop. In other words, point A, timeout is a vital tool for keeping conflicts from escalating out of control. It's perhaps the single most useful strategy for keeping peace, preventing verbal abuse and strife from damaging a loving relationship. The key is to use it before tempers flare out of control. Now, how do we do that? Well, when an aversive sequence of attack and counterattack begins, that's when most effective way to break this chain reaction and prevent emotional damage. But it takes the couple being committed to this tool. This is a powerful tool. I have seen it used successfully in my own relationships, and I have talked to many others who've used this tool and have been able to turn what could have been a terrible conflict into a healthy resolution. Item C on your outline, agree with your partner on the early warning signs that most typically lead to escalation for you, like voices getting louder, name calling, even the entrance of a controversial or sensitive subject is caution for us. We're talking about early warning signs, okay, which we need to, in other words, we need to see the yellow blinking lights here. Innuendos, you statements, you always, you never. When you hear that, the very possibility is it is an early warning sign to call for a timeout and come back and finish this conversation later. Finger pointing, facial expressions, or any form of physical threat. Another warning sign, I think, can be an overgeneralization. When sentences start with "you always" or "you never" or "nobody around here ever" or "every time I," there's a good chance that escalation is getting ready to happen. It may be time to do like the referees do and put up the timeout sign and call a timeout. Speaking of signs, item D, rules for calling a timeout. First of all, A, it's important you not use timeout to sweep things under the carpet. I have seen that done and heard of it done. I've probably been guilty of it myself. There are some things some of us would just not like to talk about at all. But we need to be sure that we are not using timeout as an avoidance tactic, a withdrawal strategy. We need to use timeout for its intended purpose, and that requires following the rules. If an hour isn't enough to fully calm down, if you're still feeling sore and hurt, make sure you arrange a time for discussion when you expect to feel less vulnerable. Item B, if an hour isn't long enough, make sure you arrange a time for discussion. Typically, a timeout should only be for about an hour. If it's late at night, when resources are down and people are tired, maybe a timeout needs to go till tomorrow morning. C, no last words. Stop action. When one partner calls a timeout, the other partner has two options. A, say nothing more, or say, okay, timeout. But that's all. That's it. Everything stops. That was the last word. Under no condition should there be any further discussion. Honor the timeout. The person calling the timeout should leave the room or house immediately for about an hour. The person calling the timeout needs to know that the answer to the timeout is not to slam out the door and scream out the driveway with tire squealing as if I'm never coming back. No, that's not a timeout. That's a cop-out. I'm talking about a timeout when it's agreed that, look, things are, yeah, I'm out of control here, or I can see you're getting out of control, but things are getting hot. We better stop this before we go in the crazy hole, and we better call a timeout, and let's take a break, take some deep breaths, and come back when we're both cooled down. Stop talking for a set period of time, usually about an hour. Stay out of the presence of the other person the entire time. Don't return early. Next item, next bullet on your list there. Always return when the timeout is up. Always return when the timeout is up. Item F, don't use drugs or alcohol during the timeout. Don't use drugs or alcohol during the timeout. They can exacerbate feelings of anger, cause impulsivity, and reduce inhibition and self-control. Definitely not an option. G, don't rehearse what you said or should have said. It's inadvisable to call or visit friends because you'll tend to complain or to build a case against your partner. That's not the purpose of the timeout. The purpose of the timeout is for both of us to come apart so we can both cool down, simmer down, and get our objectivity back. H, during the stop action period, check in with your mate. When the timeout is over, I'm sorry. Item H, during the stop action period, do something constructive. Do something constructive. Pray, journal, walk, exercise, run, ride a bike, whatever. Do the dishes, vacuum the floor, start a household project you've been meaning to get to. Do something constructive. And then, lastly, check in with your mate when the timeout is over. Ask if your partner is ready to talk about the issue at hand. Another tool is the speaker-listener technique. The speaker-listener technique is a simple and effective way to add some structure to your communication that enables you to overcome allowing these four patterns we just talked about derailing you. It's discussed in a favorite book of mine, Fighting for Your Marriage. Fighting for Your Marriage. Trying to recall the author. Slipped my mind, but it's an excellent technique that offers couples an alternative way when communication issues are hot or sensitive, or when they're likely to get that way. Any conversation that you want to enhance clarity and safety can benefit from this technique. And when it comes to handling sensitive issues concerning money, sex, in-laws, you know, having that safety net, that's what this technique provides and can be a real security, a real benefit for actually being able to talk through an issue. Again, there's rules that we need to follow to make the speaker-listener technique pay off. There's rules for both the speaker and the listener, and those are, one, the speaker has the floor. I know in counseling, a lot of times I use a real object to designate the floor. I used to keep a piece of linoleum in my briefcase. In seminars, we hand out a little piece of linoleum sometimes, or carpet for couples to use, as this is the symbol of the floor. Who's got the floor? And if you don't have the floor, you're the listener. The speaker has the floor. As speaker and listener, you follow the rules for each role. Rule two, share the floor. Take turns sharing the floor over the course of the conversation. And rule number three is no problem solving, no problem resolution. The focus in using the speaker-listener technique in a conflict, the focus is on exploring the issues and feelings, and its focus is understanding, not trying to come to solutions prematurely. It's not we're trying to fix this. It's, first of all, we're interacting, we're getting both sides of it, we're allowing both parties to speak. Rules for the speaker: speak for yourself. Don't try to be a mind reader. Talk about your thoughts, your feelings and concerns, not your perceptions of the listener's point of view. For the speaker, keep what you have to say brief and manageable. Don't go on and on and on and on and on. The reason for this, we'll get to in just a moment. But stop and let the listener paraphrase. In other words, if you go on and on and on, then when it's time for the listener to paraphrase, they're not going to be able to remember everything you said. If the paraphrase wasn't quite accurate, you should politely restate what was not heard the way it was intended to be heard. Okay? So share a little bit, stop and let the listener paraphrase. Share a little bit more, stop and let the listener paraphrase. Share a little bit more. So don't feel like you have to say it all at once. You'll send the listener into information or emotional overload. Rules for the listener. One, paraphrase what you hear. You must paraphrase what the speaker is saying. Not your opinion about it, not your reaction to it, not your defense about it, not your fix for it. Paraphrase what the speaker is saying. Did you get the feeling? Paraphrase what, listen particularly close to what feelings were being expressed. Briefly repeat back what you heard the speaker say in your own words. Make sure if you have a question, ask, did you mean, okay, you can ask a question, but your key is being a listener. Now, when the speaker is finished talking, it's not time for you to take the floor back. You are paraphrasing. Paraphrasing is a listener, part of a listener role. Focus on the speaker's message. Item two, as a listener, don't rebut. In the listener's role, you may not offer your thoughts, your opinions, or your reactions. May not offer your thoughts, your opinions, or your reactions. This tool is an incredible tool for helping the two of you stay on track and talk through these sensitive issues and be heard and to bring understanding. But the rules must be followed. After the paraphrase has been completely done, then it is okay for the listener to say, now may I have the floor? Well, on your handout there are some ground rules for handling conflict. I'm not going to go through all of those ground rules. We're just about out of time for today, but I put them in there for you as consideration as a couple to come up with what you consider as a ground rule. These are our ground rules as a couple. These are the things we know. If we don't have some guidelines and some ground rules, that we will escalate, we will end up having unmanageable conflict. But these are some rules that we're going to agree with as a couple, that we're going to be willing to sign our name to. and say that, you know what, we're going to honor these rules for communication and handling conflict in our relationship. Well, I hope some of these ideas have been helpful to you today, and it's been a pleasure spending this time with you. I look forward again to our next meeting. Take care, and God bless.